Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Have humans changed in the last 10,000 years, or are we biologically the same as we have been for the last 40 to 50,000 years, or perhaps more? Some recently considered evidence suggests that so-called civilization has promoted rapid evolutionary change in our species in the last 10,000 years. So, in this edition of Radio Curious, we will visit with Gregory Cochran, a physicist and anthropologist and the author of The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution. His book asserts that changes in human biology, lactose tolerance and resistance to malaria, for example, represent human evolution accelerated by civilization. In this, the first of two Radio Curious conversations with Gregory Cochran, we discuss some of these changes in our species and why they may have occurred. I spoke with Gregory Cochran from his home in Albuquerque, New Mexico, on February 23, 2009, and began by asking him what biological indications exist to show an increase in human evolution in the past 10,000 years. Gregory Cochran, welcome to Radio Curious. Your book, The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution, indicates that a lot more has happened in the past 10,000 years than has been previously considered. So my question is, why?
Well, we think the biggest reason is that most people in most parts of the world change their way of life a lot. Previously, people had been hunter-gatherers, hunting wild animals, gathering wild plants, and increasingly people became farmers of some kind. And that changed people's lives a lot. And those changes eventually selected for genetic changes.
When you say they selected for genetic changes, is that self-sexual selection or genetic mutations where the new human being actually got along better in the new circumstances?
You know, I would say probably a lot of it was new mutations. There's also existing different varieties of a gene. Some became more common, some became less, you know, in terms of how well they worked in the new situation. But there were a lot of new challenges and demands in this new way of life. I mean, the simplest one is you're eating something different, and that, although it's something people could do, it wasn't something people were terribly good at.
You mean eating something different they weren't good at?
Yeah, I mean, they weren't well adapted to the new diet. They could obviously survive on it, or they could never have switched to it at all, but that doesn't mean they were well adapted to it. In fact, there's kind of interesting signs of it. If you look at the fossil record, when people switched, say in the Middle East, from being hunter-gatherers to farmers, they got shorter. Something like 5 inches shorter. There were enough calories, but the new diet was probably short in vitamins and other things. Although there was a lot more food and eventually more people, and that meant that there was more human crowding, and so infectious disease became a much bigger problem than it had ever been before, and people adapted to that too. And the form of society changed. You now had towns, you had government, you had landlords and bosses. Some people were better at navigating those new circumstances than others, and as always, there's at least some genetic influence on that sort of thing.
You also indicate in your book the fact that a larger population base allows for a greater opportunity for spontaneous mutations.
Right. I mean, most mutations are not good for anything. They either don't do much or they do something bad, and then they dwindle away over time. But a very small fraction, does something good, something that works well, at least in a given situation. So if you had a mutation, for example, the most famous one, the best understood one, is one that let people continue to digest milk as adults. That ended up becoming very common in some parts of the world among people who raise cattle or goats. Apparently, you know, there was no real payoff to this in the past. You know, without domesticated animals, what's the advantage, an adult being able to drink milk? But you know, when the situation changed, and again, because of culture, when people invented new situations, when they domesticated animals, you know, we created the changes, but then the changes affected us. over time.
Going back when our species were in close proximity to Neanderthals, you indicate that there was interbreeding between the two different groups.
We think it's likely. I don't think it's not yet proven, but we should know this more certainly in a few years because we're starting to get some genetic information from Neanderthal skeletons. But we think it's likely there was at least some interbreeding. And our point we made is if there was any interbreeding at all, there's a good chance that at least a few Neanderthal genes would have been useful. And if they were, we probably acquired them.
Do you have any indications as to what those genes may have been?
Well, I can tell you one example. Of course, this is something that's tentative at the moment, and it's surprising, too. There is a gene called FOXP2, which is involved in language. Certain families where people have a broken version of this, they'll have a lot of problems with certain kinds of speech, certain parts of grammar. And we know that in humans as a whole, this gene, a new version, appears to have swept over the human race relatively recently. You can tell because there's very little variation. It's almost all the same. And people have estimated a time for how old that gene is, the current version, of about 47,000 years. Now, by the way, these estimates have a lot of slop in them, so that may be wrong, but that's the estimate we have.
So what is that new gene? What does it allow us to do that we could not have done before?
It may give us better speech. It would be odd if we picked this up from Neanderthals, but it's not impossible. The reason it seemed likely is because we've also found it in Neanderthals, but from earlier periods than this time that it appears to have originated in humans. If this pans out, and this is all pretty tentative at the moment, that would suggest one possible gene we might have picked up from Neanderthals, one that might have given people improved speech.
And that improved speech would be allowing us to control the vocal cords and the larynx.
More in the nature of how we structure words and so forth. Those families that have a messed up version of FOXP2, it's not so much the actual physical throat that's changed, it's sort of the processing in the brain. We don't know enough about what this gene does. What we know is that when broken, people have fairly severe speech problems, and we also know that it appears that a new version has recently spread in humans. But exactly how all these things work together, I don't know, and I kind of think nobody else really does yet either. There's another thing. These are not particularly likely to be from Neanderthals, but there's another related thing. It appears that new versions of several genes involved in hearing, and by the way, those we know pretty well because when they're profoundly damaged, somebody will be deaf. There seem to be new versions of those genes have spread, some in the human race as a whole, over the last 40 or 50,000 years. Some of them have been regional. You'll find certain genes that affect hearing that have become common in China and that you don't find much in, say, Europe or Africa. So the hearing stuff is probably related to speech processing, since that's probably the most important thing that's possibly been changing. I don't think bird songs have been changing that much over the past 50,000 years.
So are you indicating that the genes that would affect a person's ability to perceive sound affect their ability with regard to speech and grammar?
At some point, yeah. I mean, for example, you can have differences, and these are typically differences in these little hair cells in the inner ear. They would affect how well you could distinguish certain speech sounds, for example, or how well you could distinguish them perhaps when there was, you know, noise masking them, things of that sort.
And this is entirely different than a person who would grow up speaking the language that we are using now would have a much more difficult time learning Chinese than an infant who would grow up in a bilingual culture.
Here's something we do know. Suppose you try to teach an adult the sounds of a language that is fairly different from his. There'll be speech sounds that are hard for him to make, but it's harder for some people than others. I mean, people's abilities on this are not exactly the same for everybody. You can take two people, both 40, both who grew up in the United States, and we'll try to teach them some of the sounds in, let's say, one of the Bushman Click languages. And certain people find them easier to learn than others. Now, everybody finds them easier when they're two. But the point is there are individual differences as well. If you were better at these, I mean, perhaps you were better at eavesdropping. Perhaps you were better at hearing somebody talk when there's some other interference. Maybe you're a little better at understanding somebody when he talks rapidly. All of those things could be valuable. And changes that led to that could quite possibly be favored. So certainly some sort of changes appear to have been favored.
Favored to what extent?
Well, I mean, some of them to the extent that now most or all people have like this, the FOXP2 version, it appears to be about 50,000 years old, and now, as far as we know, everyone has the new version. There's other changes, these hearing genes, that many people will have, but not everyone. Or many people in one part of the world will have, but not everyone. So it's variable.
Have you found that these genes or any other specific ones that you may be able to share with us affect one aspect of behavior that was expected and other aspects of behavior that were unanticipated?
Well, and the hearing genes, I haven't heard anybody look at things they might do behavior. There are other genes which there's at least some indication that one form or the other form will have some effect on behavior. There's a gene called MAOA. What its main function is to break down neurotransmitters, the chemical messengers of the brain, and there are two variants. One breaks them down rapidly, one breaks them down slowly. Both of them are fairly common, although the frequencies vary from one group to another. Now, there are some studies that claim that when you have the slow form, the one that slowly breaks down things, that these people have somewhat different behavior. They are more likely... they're more likely to get into certain kinds of trouble, particularly if they have a difficult upbringing. They're more likely to end up in prison. Anyhow, there are at least some studies that suggest that, it may be that some people are, perhaps they become angry more easily or something like that. I don't think we know exactly what's going on, but there are variants in that. And in general, this sort of thing, we have models that, and also some examples pretty well known in animals, that you have things in which neither answer is the right answer. They're sort of a balance. So, for example, in a situation where no one ever got mad, for example, a rare person who did get angry when people treated him poorly, he might have an advantage. Maybe he'd get his way. On the other hand, if there's too many people like this, at some point they start fighting each other. And, so the advantage would become less. You can have things like that where you have a balance of what you might call strategies or ways of going about things. This may be one such.
The behavioral concepts that you mentioned earlier of people who have a greater tendency to end up incarcerated would present an interesting conversation for criminal defense lawyers.
Well, it's by no means inevitable, but it seems that there's a somewhat different odd, and it also probably depends upon many other environmental factors.
Yet here in California, people who are arrested for felonies have their genetic structure swabbed from the inside of their cheek. So at some point that may be revealed. But that's perhaps a conversation for another day.
But in the meantime, before we worry about the legal implications of understanding how this works, the first thing you have to do is understand it. And we're not terribly far along with that, although we know a few things.
Well, I want to ask some more questions about understanding it, but first I would like to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Gregory Cochran from his home in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He's the co-author of The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Gregory, I've wondered about blood types and how they may have originated from the food that was available to people in pre-agricultural days. Can you talk about that?
Well, I'm not sure there's a link with food, but I can tell you a link with a couple of things. I mean, the real difference in blood types is whether there are certain molecules that are attached to the outside of red blood cells. In some cases, like this particular set of things, some people don't have it attached. Those people have type O. Other people have different forms attached. Those people have type A or B, or AB, which means they have some of each kind. In most populations, you find all of these types, although the fractions vary. If you look at Indians in South America, almost everybody had type O. If you look at South and East Asia, there's quite a bit of type B. Again, there's some variation in this. And one question is why do we have several kinds? If one kind was just better, wouldn't it just increase until everybody had it? And the answer is, in certain areas of the world, that is probably what did happen. As I said, South American Indians are almost 100% type O. Perhaps in that situation, type O was the best answer, and it spread until everybody had it. We now know, for example, and this is interesting because people have been wondering about this for many years, we have at least one concrete example where we now have good evidence that type O makes you healthier, which is if you're exposed to malaria. Now, mind you, this wasn't a problem in the Americas because malaria wasn't there back then. It's something that Columbus brought over. But in Africa, for example, type O blood gives you a certain protection against the most serious kind of malaria. And it's kind of cheap protection compared to some of the other things, such as sickle cell. There are a number of different special genetic things in Africa and Southern Asia, places where malaria has existed for a long time. There are a number that give people some protection against malaria, but just recently they've finally determined that type O is one of those, although it's a harmless one as far as I know. Some of the others are not so harmless.
Well, this conversation tends towards the development of isolated groups of people. And one of the isolated groups of people that you address in the 10,000-year explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution, is the Jewish people of Ashkenazi origin. And your research indicates that there's a higher intelligence quotient than among the larger selection, the larger group of people worldwide. Can you explain that, elaborate on that?
Well, the first is, you know, is there good evidence that that is the case? And we have some IQ test results, and probably a typical score is something like 112, whereas the typical European average is more like 100. But there's also a tremendous amount of high intellectual achievement, which is something you might expect to see more of in a group with a higher average IQ, such as people winning, Ashkenazi Jews, European Jews, winning about a quarter of the Nobel Science prizes, highly represented in mathematics. I mean, I could talk about things like literature, but then we talk about, opinions more as to, what's really good and what's really not. In science and mathematics, there's not so much disagreement about, whether somebody's really achieved, so I tend to stick to that. It's also an area I know fairly well.
So what brought this about?
What we think happened, and this is, this is not proven beyond a shadow of a doubt, but we think it was natural selection that favored people with higher IQs had more children over a period of about 1,000 years, covering most of the Middle Ages. And at the same time, with other special circumstances, that the sort of that meant that this was possible because they had a very unusual mix of jobs that depended more heavily on IQ than the typical job, the typical job being a small farmer for most people, most other groups. And also, another special pattern was that they had very low rates of, at least after a while, they had very low rates of intermarriage with their neighbors. And if you end up, for a process like this to make a group different, the group has to intermarry at a low rate. If intermarries a lot, they'll be like their neighbors. And it doesn't take too much for that to be true. If you married 10% of the time with your neighbors, you would inevitably be very much like them. So we have a situation in which a group that did very, very little intermarriage, had a special set of jobs, was in a situation where doing well at those jobs led to higher incomes and larger and considerably larger families. That's another thing which has changed in the present. Typically, people who have the most money are not famous for having the most kids today, but for most of the Middle Ages, that was true, and not just in the Jews, but in essentially all groups in Europe and in many other parts of the world, places like China as well. People raise more kids if they were wealthier. Today, it's not so much that way.
So staying with the Ashkenazi Jews in North Central Europe, how long ago was this population that you're addressing? How long ago did they live there?
Well, they sort of started around the year 800 in the Rhineland, and then later sometimes moved, sometimes were pushed to various other places, on the whole moving towards Central and Eastern Europe, from Western Europe originally. So this group was living there basically from around 800 or a little after to the 20th century when Hitler, of course, killed most of them or drove them out. So we're talking more than 1,000 years.
And they were culturally self-contained by their own, by the desire of the group and by the desire of non-members of the group.
Yeah, that's pretty much true. One of the reasons they appear to have stayed particularly self-contained in Eastern Europe is Eastern Europe was typically less developed than Western Europe, and there's, in Jewish history, there tends to be sort of a tendency to be more interested in the outside culture when it's, say, advanced and looks impressive. And I think they didn't consider that particularly true in 1400 in Poland or in Russia. But they were surprisingly self-contained. To the point where, for example, probably in 1900, probably the average Jew in Poland really wasn't very fluent in Polish.
What was their language?
Yiddish, which is a mix of several things, originally probably German, mixed with Hebrew, many Hebrew words, and a spattering of other things, such as some Slavic words.
In your experience studying this issue and isolated cultures, have you found similar groups that have had what you believe is a greater intelligence level?
I would say the answer is maybe, but I'm not at all confident of it. You need special situations. First, you need to be genetically isolated from other people, and in Europe, that wasn't very common. I mean, there were really only two groups that were genetically isolated from other people. The problem may be only the Jews. By the way, not completely and always. It appears in early days of the Jewish founding populations in Europe, there was more mixture. If you look at them, they have quite a bit of European admixture, but you can also tell it's not recent. It might have been back in Roman times. Some of these rules that banned intermarriage both within the Jewish community and pressure from outside, some of those rules really only developed later. You know, the lack of intermarriage is unusual. The occupational specialization is unusual. I don't think there's any other group like this in Europe. There might be in India. In India, with the caste system, people have split into different groups that have, on average, different occupations and at least moderately low intermarriage. It's at least possible something like this has happened in some Indian caste. But there's no overwhelming, or in some group that was sort of like that, such as the Parsis in India, which is not technically a caste, but was sort of treated as if they were. They're really a separate group of a separate religion other than Hinduism, Zoroastrianism. It could have happened, but I don't think we have any strong evidence on it.
Within the Jewish group, there was also a development of serious diseases that would kill children at 2 or 3 years old, like Tay-Sachs. Did you find any of those in the Indian population?
We think that those mutations became common because they had advantages for carriers. It's hard, and when we do analysis of it, we can't see how they could become common elsewise. But and some of them look biochemically as if they might have increased intelligence. Tay-Sachs, for example, in a carrier. In India, I'm not aware of any kind of information like that, but I might not know. I mean, one of the reasons that this study was possible is there's been a lot of investigation of Jewish medical genetics. There hasn't been the same degree of investigation of these groups in India, although that data may be accumulating. But the point is, it's not done yet. The Parsis, for example, I know some accounts that they have certain things that make you wonder. They have a high frequency of breast cancer. They have a high frequency of Parkinson's disease, which is, could tell you something neurological is going on. But I don't think we know enough to say anything, really. The reason we talk about the Parsis at all is because they're very accomplished, considering their numbers. They're very prominent. But at the same time, their numbers are not large at all. There are less than 100,000 of them in the world. But they're very prominent in India in commerce and intellectually. It's enough so that some of them have been heard of outside of India. Not a lot, because we're only talking about 70,000 people. But, Zubin Mehta was Parsi. Freddie Mercury was Parsi.
Going back to Tay-Sachs, you mentioned that would have a possible link to increased intelligence. What would that be?
Well, the reason that we suspect that is, first, it's both deadly enough and common enough that it needs some explanation. The second reason is that when you look at the details of what it does biochemically, it causes the buildup of a compound. This is the compound that acts as a messenger that makes nerve cells grow more little branches, dendrites. Now, in the actual sick children, they exhibit this, but it's not one that makes them smarter. Stuff is building up until it destroys those nerve cells. But in a carrier, you wouldn't have this tremendous buildup. You'd only have a slight increase in this compound, and most recently, you'd expect to see a few more dendrites. And that might be something that could be positive, at least in some situations.
Well, Gregory Cochran, there's obviously a lot more to talk about, and pending that, I would like to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious and ask if there's an important concept or idea that you could share with us, either related to your book, The 10,000-Year Explosion, or something else.
Well, you keep getting this molecular information. It applies to many questions as we sequence lots of genes. And one thing we found is that some of our classification of the mammals, it turned out we were confused by animals that looked similar, but in fact their ancestry is not at all close. The particular thing we found is there's a strange class of animals that doesn't look like it has much in common with each other, but it turns out they're all related, and they're now calling this group the Afrotheria. You know, mammals go back a long time. There were mammals back in the time of the dinosaurs, small ones at least, and sometimes they would get isolated on a continent as the continent split apart and go their own way. We all know this has happened in Australia to some extent, where you have marsupials. But it also happened for a long time. Africa was an island continent, and they had more advanced mammals, placental mammals, but they were not connected with the rest of the world. And those mammals evolved into many different niches, some of which made them look very much like animals in other continents that they weren't closely related to. And some of them are still around, and some of them are quite familiar. The most famous member would be the elephants. They're a member of this Afrotheria. There are the manatees, which, surprisingly enough, are related to elephants. There's a thing called the golden mole, which is found in South Africa. It looks very much like an ordinary mole. It tunnels through the ground. It's blind. It has, strong legs and so forth, a tunnel. But it's more closely related to an elephant than it is a regular European or American mole. It's sort of interesting that traditional people doing classification by looking at bones and things had not caught on to most of it. They caught on to some. They had figured out there must be some relationship between the manatees and the elephants.
And the new revelation comes from examining the DNA.
Yeah. And when things have had long enough to diverge and, the job shapes the animal, and after a while, any mole is going to look like a mole. Functionally, it kind of has to look that way. And it's hard to tell that it's more closely related to something very different. There's other things of this sort, but that's the most dramatic example. Is they're having to rewrite when they draw the tree of descent of mammals, they've had to rewrite some parts of it. They weren't wrong about everything, but it's kind of a fun and interesting example of where this new genetic information has taken us.
And finally, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Well, there's a book I finished just about a week ago, which touches upon something I mentioned in this. It's a book called Twilight of the Mammoths by Paul S. Martin. And it talks about the extinctions of the large animals that used to live in places like North America and South America. In North America, there was at least as much big, wild, and dangerous game as there is in Africa today.
Well, Gregory Cochran, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you.
Gregory Cochran is the co-author of The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution. The book he recommends is The Twilight of the Mammoths, Ice Age Extinctions and the Rewilding of America by Paul S. Martin. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.